Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello there, Angry Planet listeners. This is Matthew. We've gotten a flood of new listeners in the past 30 days, and we've been recording a lot of really great episodes that we don't want to put behind the paywall. And given the situation in Ukraine and this flood of new listeners, we want to let them know kind of what those premium episodes look like and what we do. So we're going to release them on the mainstream this month. I really hope doesn't upset our Substack listeners too much. But this episode in particular is one of the ones that would have normally been behind a paywall. But we thought it would be good to release it here. We're also recording another one that's about the changing nature of tank combat in land wars and what this war in Ukraine means for that. It's another episode that would have been paywalled that's going to be going out to everybody. So enjoy. If you like what we do here, we're at angryplanetpod.com. But without further ado, I'll get out of your way and let you listen to this excellent episode. People live in a world of their own making. Frankly, that seems to be the problem. Welcome to Angry Planet. Hello, and welcome to Angry Planet. I'm Matthew Galt. Jason Fields is busy working for a living today. It's the end of the world as we know it, and I'm pretty tired. Russia is at war with Ukraine. Vladimir Putin is making vague nuclear threats. Both Russia and U.S. officials are mostly trying to dial things down. A Russian defense official said that they don't have their hands on the button, and the Pentagon said it had canceled the test of a Minuteman missile. And yet, days later, the U.S. head of Strategic Command said America needed to modernize its nuclear forces and reminded everyone that the test had been postponed and not canceled. If all of this is leaving you a bit anxious about the possibility of nuclear war, you're not alone. And to be clear, the possibility of nuclear war is still damn low, but that doesn't always make the anxiety go away. Something that has always helped me deal with the threat of nuclear hellfire is pop culture. And that's what we're going to talk about today. And here to help me with that is Jacqueline Brick. Brick is an analog role-playing game personality, a nuclear policy dilettante, and a nuke wonk gadfly. She's also the wonderful writer of many fine games, including the Tin Candles hack Nuke, quote, a simple, stark game about slowly dying in a city hit by a nuclear weapon. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So
I don't know if your listeners know this, but I've been bugging you to introduce me in a podcast as a nuclear policy dilettante for the last year. And here we are, finally.
Here we are.
At the end of the world.
Yeah, it just, all it took was a land war in Europe to get us here.
No kidding. So before we go into nuclear pop culture, I had no idea the Pentagon was like, oh, we just postponed the test of a Minuteman missile.
Yeah, so the press secretary had come out and said, like, hey, this is canceled. We're not doing this right now, right? And then yesterday, Strategic Command, I can't remember his name, was testifying, and he's like, look, we need to modernize our ICBM silos and all this X, Y, and Z. And also, we're still going to test that Minuteman missile. We're just holding off, exactly, yeah.
Listeners, you can't see me, but I am making a jack-off motion. Catch me gatekeeping ICBMs from U.S. Stratcom at this point.
Well, just anytime Stratcom talks, someone should be in the background doing that. Yeah.
Exhausting.
Their social media presence, though okay recently, is an all-time nightmare.
Yes.
That's like a whole other tangent. What's your anxiety level right now vis-a-vis nukes and the end of the world?
So weirdly, my anxiety level vis-a-vis nukes is quite low. I mostly hang out on nuclear Twitter with people like Martin Pfeiffer and Jeffrey Lewis and your own good self. And people who actually know about nukes are very, very clear that no, nukes aren't going off anytime soon. We're probably still around DEFCON 5 or DEFCON 4. And for those of you listening who think that sounds really dangerous, DEFCON counts down, not up. But my anxiety is more around people who think they understand nukes. And to give a couple more credentials, because you gave me a wonderful intro and I really appreciate that. My degree is in international relations with a focus in post-Soviet politics. So what has been happening since February 24th has been affecting me pretty deeply. And there is nothing more rage-inducing than seeing people go, Russia is invading Ukraine to blow up Chernobyl and turn Europe into a nuclear wasteland. That's their entire plan. And attempting to explain to people that nuclear fallout doesn't actually stop at national borders. And Pripyat is close enough to Russia that they'd be heavily endangering themselves by doing that is nearly impossible, because people have catapulted directly back into Gen X anxiety. And I guess the best way of putting this is we're seeing the mutation of Gen X anxiety in real time because of social media.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. The one that gets me, and I had to, like, in real time debunk a friend the other day who knows better, was telling me about how he's worried about a dirty bomb. Some of the like fissile material being collected. To give the listeners just like a very quick thing. Like if you ever hear anybody about somebody storming a nuclear plant to get nuclear material to make a dirty bomb, they don't know what the fuck they're talking about.
They do not. Also, there's a Robin Williams bit about this from 2001 where he just grabs his crotch and goes, oh, you like the Russians with the dirty bomb. And that's all I can think of. Am I allowed to swear on this podcast?
Yeah.
That's all I can fucking think of whenever anyone's like, oh no, dirty bomb, suitcase nuke.
The just very simply, like the weight of nuclear material would make it very hard to make what people would traditionally think of as a dirty bomb out of something. The explosion that is caused is always going to be much worse than whatever they think is going to be aerosolized. But anyway, setting that aside,
I don't think people actually understand the weight and density of nuclear material. Like one of my favorite sort of nuclear accidents, because I'm the sort of person who has favorite nuclear accidents, is the Demon Core.
Yeah.
And something I didn't realize until recently is that the Demon Core, which has caused so many problems for so many people, was only 3 inches across.
Tell the audience what the Demon Core is.
Oh, I'm so glad you asked. The Demon Core was a nuclear, not warhead exactly, but experimental nuclear ball of material that's about as plebeian as I can go with it, that killed, gosh, let me look up how many people it killed. It was called the Demon Core because
it had a long tail.
It was cursed.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's okay. So it's 3 inches across. How much do you think it weighs, Matthew?
Oh, it's shocking. And I can't remember what it is, but you're about to tell me.
14 pounds.
Yeah.
It is the size of a large, it is the weight of a large cat. And it's 3 inches across. It killed 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. 8 people were involved with it and were hit with supercritical radiation. I think only 2 of them actually died at the scene, but
yeah,
it was enough that this core, this tiny, honestly, freaking tiny piece of plutonium And it's literally referred to as a subcritical mass, in case you want to, you know, use the actual scientific term instead of an orb. You could, in fact, ponder the demon core if you wanted to. It is a favorite pastime of mine. But this orb, this 3-inch orb, caused enough problems for the people studying in the Los Alamos laboratory that they eventually just had to take it apart.
Yeah, and you, like, so, you know, you translate that into thinking somebody's going to make a suitcase nuke. It's not feasible. Like, it's just not going to happen. Don't worry about that.
One of the funniest things I think about nuclear accidents like that is one of the accidents at the Los Alamos laboratory was literally a guy stacking bars of plutonium, and he drops one in the middle, and had he not reached in, you know, reflexively to be like, oh no, he wouldn't have died. But oops, now his hand is in the middle of the sun.
Yeah,
bummer.
I think that's one of the things that fascinates me about it is so much of it is invisible to the naked eye that it feels like a magical force in some way. Tell me so you and I are younger, I think, than the generation that is traditionally frightened of nuclear weapons.
Yeah, I was born in 92, so like a year after the fall of the Berlin Wall.
So I have found with people, you know, around that generation that are interested in this thing, there's an origin story. Mm-hmm. Something happened that made them get interested in this. What's yours?
So mine is kind of funny. I was homeschooled for much of my life, and I was homeschooled because of my ADHD. And my parents at the time did not realize that special interests and hyperfocuses were part of ADHD. They just knew that I had, at the age of 6, developed a really quite alarming interest in the wreck of the Titanic. But they decided that if they were going to continue homeschooling me, they wanted me and my sister to be socialized. So we became part of a homeschooling co-op. And one of my friends in the co-op had movie nights in his basement because his mom was very interested in showing, you know, these homeschooled kids the classics and, you know, getting us some culture. And one movie night happened to be Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb.
How old were you?
I was 11.
Oh, wow.
Maybe a little early.
Yeah.
I did not understand all of the jokes like I do now. And I wasn't sure I would enjoy it because I didn't really enjoy war films at the time. I still don't. It really depends on the war film. But these images of the clouds and the way people were treating this crisis in that movie, both as a cudgel and as basically treating the crisis in every single extreme you can possibly think of. Like, it's not a real crisis. It's a real crisis. This crisis will cause me to be able to push my political agenda. I got really, really interested in that. And I don't think my parents were thrilled by that, because this is around the same time we were studying World War II in my history class. And then I started reading up about the bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and I was like, oh my God, what the hell? And the sort of monumental horror image of the nuclear cloud has really stuck with me to this day.
So where do you put Dr. Strangelove now?
I do not put it in my holy, I guess it is a holy trinity of nuclear films. It is definitely a film I will watch when I'm sad, because it's extremely funny, especially once you understand that what Kubrick is trying to say is that nukes are the dicks we wave at each other. But, like, it's fine. It's not my favorite, but I will definitely watch it if someone is like, hey, Jax, you like nukes? Do you want to watch a nuclear movie? And for being such a dark comedy, it's incredibly realistic.
That's the thing that I like about it is it's like, can you imagine the early 1960s, right? That thing comes out. Mm-hmm. Like those are pretty similar to the conversations that are actually happening, but just played for laughs. The tone is different.
I am literally waiting for Lindsey Graham to go, "One night I couldn't complete the act of lovemaking."
Yeah. Yeah, I can see it. As a South Carolinian now, lots of thoughts on Lindsey Graham. None of them good. But, okay, what's in your Holy Trinity?
So, a lot of people who engage with nuclear media, and I guess it's fair to say that my special interest now is more nuclear media than it is actual nuclear policy, but I am a dilettante, which I'm still really happy about. Everyone who's involved, everyone who watches nuclear films has their Holy Trinity, and the top of everyone's Holy Trinity is Threads. That one is indisputable. I have never met anyone who enjoys realistic nuclear media and doesn't say that Threads is their favorite movie. My second one is actually probably The War Game, the 1965 one by Peter Watkins. That is actually sort of the granddaddy of all these other films. And it has my single favorite line about nuclear weapons in any media.
Give me the line.
The line is, "At this distance, a I screwed it up. Let me look it up so I can read it to you in the voice.
Yeah, and the dry British narrator voice.
Oh, it's perfect. It's so perfect.
I'm going to mug while you're doing that. So
do it.
That one is super fascinating to me because I think at the time I saw it, I had to find a pirated copy because it had aired, I believe, once on television in the 60s when it was commissioned by the BBC. Or no, it hadn't been. It had aired for executives, and then the executives were like, "We shouldn't show this to people." And then they had a screening in a movie theater. That was attended lightly by the public, whoever, I guess, could get into the movie theater. And this thing was very controversial at the time. It's only about 50 minutes long, and it's it's incredibly good, and it's kind of a style of thing that no one was making at the time, where it's a documentary as if a nuclear war is happening, and it's kind of set in Britain. I think Sheffield, a smallish.
I don't think so. I think it's in the Northeast. It's
the Northeast. Okay.
Oh, are we talking about Threads or are we talking about the War Game?
War Game.
Threads is set in Sheffield.
Okay.
The War Game is mostly set in and around London, if I remember correctly.
Okay. Yeah, I think, yeah, you're right. And so it's this stark black and white 50 minute, what feels like a documentary, and Watkins, the director, used basically all the civil service and home defense stuff that was available to put together, what it would actually look like if a nuke went off in Britain, if nuclear war happened. And it's fascinating and strange, and it absolutely terrified BBC executives, and and it was strangely, even though it was a faux documentary, it was nominated that year for an Oscar, as a documentary film. And then the BBC basically put it in a vault and where it sat for decades, until it recently started to kind of get some airplay. And it's one of those that's comes onto YouTube occasionally.
It's on archive.org as well.
It is on archive.org, and it bubbled up on Netflix for a little while, of all places.
Oh, weird, really?
Yeah, yeah. Awesome. I don't know if it's there anymore, but it was definitely there for a little bit. He's got another great... Have you ever seen any of his other stuff? Other Watkins stuff?
I know about Punishment Park. I haven't seen it.
The other one I've seen is Culloden, which is about the Battle of Culloden between the Scottish and the English. Mm-hmm. And similar thing, it's about an hour long, and he filmed it where the battle was taking place, and it's in that same War Game style where it's a faux documentary.
Awesome. I love his work, and I don't remember if he narrates the documentary himself, but whoever he got to narrate the War Game, just it's phenomenal. It's perfect.
Give me the line.
All right, I found the line. The blast wave from a thermonuclear explosion has been likened to an enormous door slamming in the depths of hell.
You're right about the delivery of all this stuff, because it's very dry and matter of fact.
That's the best line. The best part of how this movie is how dry and it's actually really fairly cruel to the viewer.
Yes.
But not in a way that it wants the viewer to like vomit or anything, or like, it's not edgy, but it is cruel.
Yeah.
There's one part I remember where I think it's the Anglican bishop who's like, I still believe in the war of the just. Da-da-da-da-da. And then the next line is immediately, in this car, a family is burning alive.
Yep. And then he gets is he the one that gets his eyes blown out too? I think. The Anglican bishop.
No, it's the little boy and the woman who goes and rescues him.
Yes, because they look at the
They look at the flash. Don't look at the flash.
Don't look at the flash, people.
That's your nuclear survival tip for today. Don't look at the flash.
Or what's the third leg of your nuclear war film triad?
So this might be a little spicy for some people, because a lot of people say it's either The Day After, which is the American version of Threads.
Mm-hmm.
And that one's okay. John Lithgow does give a wonderful performance in that one. But that one gets a little silly in parts. And it's Not When the Wind Blows, which is also excellent, but I prefer the radio play, because the radio play has the voice actor of Wallace from Wallace and Gromit playing Jim.
Oh, that's good. I've never heard the radio play.
That's on archive.org as well.
I'm going to have to look that up.
That one's rough, because you're basically hearing Wallace and his wife go through a nuclear war, and he calls her a bitch at one point, and you're like, oh.
Yeah, I don't want to hear that. I don't want to hear that voice say that word in that context. Right? That's no good.
But no, my third one is actually Testament.
I don't think I've seen this.
So Testament is based off of the 1980s short story, The Last Testament, which is a short story about a woman whose husband goes to work in San Francisco. It's either San Francisco or Los Angeles. Sorry, California city's blur for me. But her husband goes to work about 100 miles away, and then suddenly all of their TV and electronics go down, and then there's a massive flash outside the window, and all they find out is that someone nuked the US. We don't know who, we don't know why, but instead of being a direct hit like Threads or the war game, it's very much what happens when your only interaction with the bombs is fallout.
Oh, that's fascinating. I've got to see this. It's got Jason Alexander and Kevin Costner in it. I'm going to have to watch this. That's interesting.
It has this absolutely heartbreaking scene that's not in the short story, although the short story is very worth reading, where the mother is playing the piano, either playing the piano or managing the costumes for the elementary school's production of The Pied Piper. And one of the lines is, the children went away because the town wasn't worthy, and maybe in 100 years or so we'll be worthy again. And it just kind of stabs the viewer in the heart. And it's this little hope spot in the middle of this movie where everybody is slowly dying of poisoning.
Yeah.
Or radiation poisoning. And then you remember, because we were talking about this earlier, that radiation isn't magic. You can't negotiate with it.
Yeah.
You can't avoid it by doing the right hand gestures or writing the right symbols or doing the right chants. It is there, and you now have to deal with it.
It's a force, right?
It is.
Mine is Threads.
Obviously.
War Game.
Mm-hmm.
And I also have a weird one. Matinee, the Joe Dante. Have you ever seen this?
I'm not familiar with that one. Tell me about that one.
So this is the guy that directed Gremlins. Okay. It's a movie from the 90s, and I think this may be the first. My parents rented it.
Okay.
And I watched it with them as a family, and it's about a town in Florida dealing with like during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Mm-hmm. It's like everybody in the community is related to the military in some way. So like there's, you know, there's a family with like Air Force pilots and everything, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, John Goodman plays a, I can't remember what his name is. It was either William Castle or Frank Castle, the like schlock horror director from the 50s and 60s who would
I think it's Frank Castle.
It's Frank Castle who would put like the electricity in the seats to like shock people in theater and that kind of thing. And always, there was always a gimmick with whatever his bad movie was.
Sure.
Like that guy played by John Goodman comes to town at the same time and is trying to put on like a big matinee feature about a mutant ant. And so it's like kids dealing with cold, like it's dealing with the Cuban Missile Crisis and the Cold War anxiety through horror films.
Oh, I love that. It's
like trying to distract yourself with this bad movie about a mutant ant and like maybe going into the movie theater, you're going to come out to nuclear hellfire. Mm-hmm. And it's just kind of a weird tone. You know, that kind of like gremlins-y, cartoony, yet a little mean with a little edge to it kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I don't know. That one's always, maybe it's because it's one of the first ones I saw. Mm-hmm. That one's always spoken to me. I always liked that movie.
I would like to give a special mention to Terminator 2 Judgment Day for actually having one of the best nuclear scenes in fiction thus far that is not just directly about realistic nuclear war.
Yeah, I mean, that's why you see that like that screen grab everywhere online, yeah, constantly, right? It's the mm-hmm. That was the director's cut. That wasn't in the full movie, yes. I don't think. Right?
I don't know if the dream sequence is in the full movie because the only one I've actually watched is the director's cut. I know that Kyle is in the director's cut and not the full movie, but I think the nuke scene is in the normal movie. I'd have to watch it again.
Why is this? I mean, maybe it's different for you, but for me, like talking about these things and like watching these movies, I also like to play Fallout, even the bad ones. Mm-hmm. Are a comfort when dealing with this stuff? Why?
I'm so glad you asked that because I am a horror writer primarily. For those of you listening who play tabletops, you may have seen my work in Changing the Lost or Deviant or any one of personal and systemic horror games. And I think it's so comforting to just be able to take an hour or two and either watch or play or otherwise engage with something that you think is scary in a controlled environment, and then everybody else around you going, oh yeah, that's also scary, because it allows you this moment of bonding over what some people might consider a weakness. I don't necessarily consider it a weakness. And really just being able to be vulnerable in a controlled way, allowing yourself to feel these huge emotions and reaping the benefits of whatever endorphins come out of that.
Yeah, no, I think that hits the nail on the head. That's perfect. And I think the horror analogy is really good. Mm-hmm. Cause I would say that my path to this stuff also runs through, I mean, that was pretty much all I read growing up was mm-hmm. horror fiction. And it was because I was often a very scared kid, and it allowed me to like kind of grapple with these things and have a catharsis with it. Right. And like you said, experience it in a controlled and entertaining way, mm-hmm. And bond with friends that were maybe reading the same material. So to people that are new to this right now, so I feel like
Threads is a little much. That is not the movie you want to start with. I saw Talia Levin talking about how a friend of hers had been like, oh, we should watch Threads, and then not telling her what it was about. And it's like, no, you don't do that to your friends.
And, you know, we're talking around it right now. What is it? Because I think, you know, it's one of these that people may have seen images on or heard of from nuclear friends, you know, that, you know, Threads is this horrifying movie. What is it?
Threads is the movie that caused me to never want to move to Great Britain, even though my husband has a dual citizenship. It is a very, very famous or infamous. I believe it was filmed in 1983, mm-hmm. and it is set in 1984 or 85.
On March 5th.
Yes, you're correct. Thank you. It starts on March 5th.
Starts on March 5th, yes.
Yes, it starts with two young adults in a car. One is upper middle class, one is working class, and they're necking in the car as jets fly overhead. They get into a little bit of a fight. He picks her a flower, makes it up to her. They get back in the car. A couple months later, you find out she's pregnant. You find out there is a crisis in the Persian Gulf, I think.
I think so, yeah.
But you're here. This is not a military film, right? You're hearing all of these military updates in the background, which is something I love so much about this. And why I'm going to shit so hard on some of all our fears later. But the first hour of the movie is just this sort of soap opera drama. So Ruth and Jimmy are in this relationship. He gets her pregnant. He decides he's going to marry her because he's very proud and doesn't want to get an abortion. His parents for 1984 are very understanding. Like, you know, you could get it taken care of. Like, have you talked, we're just going to get married and have the baby. Grr. And he has this whole masculinity thing about taking care of Ruth. They meet, their families meet. The dads get preoccupied by the TV. Elsewhere, we see a guy who is some functionary in a local government being told that he has to go underground for his local planning committee because the threat of nuclear war is so high that they need to start getting people together to make sure there's a continuance of governance after the war. He finds out he can't take his wife. The stress starts ramping up as people start realizing what's going on, but everybody's dealing with their daily lives for the first hour of the movie. And then someone, some motherfucker, decides to use tactical nuclear weapons. And listeners, you can't see the scare quotes I'm making with my hands here. There is no such thing as a tactical nuclear weapon, and anyone who says tac nukes work is a fool, and you shouldn't be listening to them.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Matthew, do you know how many tons of dynamite are in the smallest nuclear weapon? Or not in the smallest nuclear weapon, but the blast force of the smallest nuclear weapon. Do you know what that is?
My answer to that would be, it doesn't matter. It's still a nuke.
It's 20 tons, but yeah, basically 20 tons of dynamite. The Davy Crockett, a quote unquote handheld nuke, can level two city blocks.
I mean, we don't have any more data. Well, there's probably some in storage somewhere,
but
nobody's fielding. People kept getting sick and dying when they were testing them. So nobody's fielding those anymore. But the point still stands.
Yeah, wild how being that close to a nuclear core will cause you to get sick and die.
Funny that.
Yeah. Anyway, so about 59 minutes in, after the tactical nukes get dropped, then the nukes fall on Sheffield, which is where the movie is set. I believe the entire nuke sequence takes about 5 to 15 minutes. It feels like a fucking eternity. There is no swelling orchestral music. There's no like cool sound effects other than explosions and screaming. There are no moments of heroism. It is disgusting. It is awful. Like, Something I actually like more about The Day After than I do Threads is the monumental horror image of the mushroom cloud is actually more interesting and more classically horrifying to look at. The mushroom clouds and Threads actually look fairly small.
Yeah.
Given what you're expecting. But the point isn't the mushroom cloud. The point is what's happening on ground level. Jimmy goes missing looking for Ruth. We don't see him again until the very end. Ruth's family basically dies of radiation poisoning. Ruth goes a bit mad and starts wandering through the streets of London afterwards. And then you realize that there's an entire hour of the movie to go.
Yeah.
This movie does not give you... The climax of the movie is halfway through. The rest is just the nuclear denouement.
Yeah.
And it's rough.
It's one of the only... Because usually these kinds of movies either end with the nuke or begin with it. Or it's something that happened off screen beforehand, right?
Yeah.
So to have that... The nuclear denouement is a really great way to put it. To like have that be the back half of the film and like where the movie leaves you is so brutal.
Yeah. Also, do you want to talk about the film bookend? Because yeah. There's beginning and end of the movie both start with what song?
I don't remember.
Johnny Be Good by Chuck Berry.
I can see the little girl running through the field at the end, but I can't hear the music.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Do you know about the direct line between the War Game and Threads?
I do not. I know some cool film trivia about Threads, but I do not know the direct line. Please tell me.
I've interviewed the director because I think they had the anniversary was a few years ago, and they did like a big marketing push and put out a fancy Blu-ray transfer and all this stuff. The BBC, well, like into the 80s, the story about the War Game and the BBC suppressing it was like something that people kept bringing up, and they were it was like a black mark against them.
Yep,
and they wanted to get rid of it. Mm-hmm. And so they were like, let's do the War Game again. And you know, like try to do a modern version of that. And Mick Jackson's the guy that directed it, like gets really deep into nuclear war studies, does the same thing that Watkins had done, like does all the same research, but sees like where it is 20 years later, and produces this little, another 30-minute Watkins style documentary called QED, A Guide to Armageddon. Which I believe is on YouTube. Yeah, and I'll drop a link for you. Then it's such a success that the BBC's like, well, what else you got? And Jackson was like, well, I want to do something about nukes, but I want it to be about the psychological effects on society. I want to hit it in a way that a documentary can't. And he pitched Threads. And they said, great, go for it. And that's why we have that movie. So, like, War Game getting censored leads to the creation of Threads in this roundabout way, because people at the BBC were ashamed of what had happened.
Wow.
Yeah.
And yet they still banned Threads.
Did they afterwards?
They did.
Oh, they did. You're right. Yeah. They did. Because it was, they showed it, would they show it once? And then it was, I mean, it's, I can't stress how horrifying. Like, horrifying is the wrong word, but like, it's not sexy.
No. You know,
the way that a lot of these other, the way that like a lot of stuff is, right? Like, it's very bare bones and matter of fact.
It's torture in the way torture actually works, instead of like the sort of Hellraiser sexy blades and leather way some people think torture works. It is not, it's banal.
Yes. Yeah. But that's a good way to put it. It's banal. There's no Mad Max style post-apocalyptic gangs running through. There's just people in rags trying to eat, you know, and just trying to survive.
Yeah. And like, don't get me wrong. I love a Mad Max movie. I loved Fury Road is pretty much in my top 10 movies of all time. But like, whenever people hear me say, hey, I'm looking for more nuclear media, The thing I get most often is, have you watched Mad Max? Have you played Fallout? I'm like, guys, that's not what I mean.
Well, which Fallouts? There's a big difference between all of them. I would argue those first two are actually pretty good. If you've ever played the old ones, the isometric ones.
I haven't.
I think those first two, and this is why I always play them whenever they come out, even though they make me sad now, because they're just theme parks. But the first two, I think, really do get at something. They really get at why this stuff is bad, and they really expose those anxieties of the boomer generation in some interesting ways.
That's awesome.
New Vegas too, actually, I think.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
A great anecdote. There's a faction literally called the Boomers.
Oh.
They worship like SAC pilots because they are they've settled near where like a B-52 went down, and they know it's down there. They want to excavate it. And so like the way you have to, if you want to like try to win them over to your side, you have to like go through this whole thing where you learn about their history and you start to piece together that they are the kind of people that are like the exact kind of wrong people you don't want to have nuclear weapons.
Oh, no.
They want you to help excavate this B-52 for them. It's fascinating. The New Vegas is worth playing. The first two are worth playing. The other ones are mostly like 3 and 4 and 76 are theme parks that you kind of uses, you know, I think uses the aesthetic, but doesn't really have much interesting to say.
And like no shade to you guys if you like Fallout. It is not my thing. Weirdly, Stephen King, who is one of the people I have Twitter just to yell at him to shut the fuck up, has really interesting things to say about nukes in The Stand. And it's buried because of everything else that happens in The Stand. And like, don't watch the 2020 version. It's god awful.
It was very bad.
It completely misses the point of Randall Flagg as the magical fascist. But at least the costumes were good.
What does the book have to say about nukes?
So late in the novel, Randall Flagg sends the Trash Can Man into the desert to locate the Big Fire, which is a nuclear weapon. And what he's essentially attempting to do is use this incredibly damaged, volatile young man to build an army, which I don't know of anyone who has ever done that before. The Trash Can Man blows up the airfield that they had so carefully cleared. It's like, oh no, I fucked up. If I go get him the Big Fire, then I will be forgiven. So Trash Can Man goes into the desert, gets a nuke on his little, I guess it's like a four-wheeler with a dolly behind it. And in the novel and in the 94 version, comes back covered in radioactive burns, which is not actually something that would have happened based on the type of nuke he's carrying. It's not a Minuteman, it's smaller, but
yeah, I don't remember what it was, but it was a
rocket.
It's
a rocket that you drop out of an aircraft. So it's not an ICBM. But he comes back and he's like, look, I've brought you the fire, and Flag flips out because this person that he so very carefully groomed to be his demolitions expert and, you know, is using, has now brought this incredibly dangerous device into the middle of his city at his moment of triumph, when he's going to murder the two remaining witnesses by not drowning, which was one of the worst choices made in the 2020 version, but by dismemberment via truck. And he's like, what are you doing? Why have you brought this here? And he's like, I brought you the fire. Randall Flagg starts throwing around all kinds of crazy energy. There is a literal Deus Ex Machina where Randall Flagg's energy turns into the hand of God and destroys the nuke and Vegas along with it. And it's just such an interesting commentary on the sort of people who want to use nukes, because Trash Can Man doesn't actually want to use the nuke. He just wants to please Flag. Flag really, really, really wants to use the nuke because, wow, that's so much destructive power in the palm of my hand. And by the end of the novel, it's basically his own hand that destroys himself.
Yeah. No, like that's a really good, succinct way. Like there is so much there, right? Mm-hmm. This double-edged sword that you're always kind of stabbing into your own throat. Should push it into your enemies. What makes a bad nuclear movie?
I feel like I've been saying I'm so glad you asked too many times, but these are all the sorts of questions that I wanted to be asked in this interview, and I really appreciate it. So somebody recommended the TV series Jericho to me recently.
I have seen Jericho.
Yeah, and I was like, oh, cool, that looks interesting. It has a deaf character. It has this, that, and the other. It's not really about people dealing with fallout. It's not really about people dealing with explosions. It's about people trying to uncover a conspiracy of the U.S. to nuke itself.
Did you finish it?
I got to the third series where they made the barrel bombs.
Yes, because they were nuclear barrel bombs detonated all across the country.
Yeah.
So that business interests could move the capital to Wyoming, if I remember right. Mm-hmm. And then Texas ends up saving everybody.
Yep.
But setting that aside, the reason you're not, I remember this and I just thought it was really funny. The reason they're not dealing with nuclear fallout in the TV show is because Jericho, Kansas, where it is set, is for some reason magically in this, like, the perfect place where the winds will never bring anything bad ever. I remember that distinctly. For some reason, Jericho was spared the worst of the radiation because of
its location. Alex Wellerstein. Paging right? Alex Wellerstein of Nuke Map. Alex Wellerstein to the floor, please.
Yeah, it's just very strange.
I somehow missed that bit entirely, and now I'm just even madder at it because it's not a show about nukes. It's a show about conspiracies that somehow decided that nukes are going to be the way this business interest is going to move the capital to Cheyenne for some fucking
reason. That's where it was.
Yeah, because they wanted to move it to Cheyenne Mountain.
Yeah.
And yeah. Like the 100, which is an absolutely ludicrous show that I really enjoyed, made a better use of nukes than Jericho, which is a show about nukes. Like it's absurd. People are like, oh, it's so realistic and it's really cool. And Jax, you'll really like it. Okay, I keep talking about the monumental horror image of nukes, and there's a wonderful article on The Outline by Sean T. Collins, which is what I am referencing when I say this. The mushroom cloud is something we all understand to be bad, right? Like seeing a mushroom cloud on the horizon means that the no fun times are here and no one's going to have a good time ever again. What we fail to understand about that is that any explosion big enough can make a mushroom cloud. And like, do you remember when the fireworks factory exploded in Lebanon? I think
yeah,
it was.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. With all the ammonium nitrate in it.
And there was a huge mushroom cloud and people were like, oh my God, Israel nuked Lebanon or whatever. Or yeah, like, oh my God, it's a dirty bomb or a suitcase. Like, no.
There was another round of this recently. I think it was like an ammo or a fuel depot exploded in Ukraine. Or, you know, was shot and exploded.
I think it was a fuel depot, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I had friends reaching out to me being like, oh my God, is it nuclear war? It's like, no. If you get a big enough explosion, it makes a cloud like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's actually really interesting, too, because what they did for the nuclear explosion in Threads was actually a practical effect. So they had to let the entire town know that they were just setting off this massive explosion for those couple of shots so that they didn't freak out. It's actually why they thank the town of Sheffield in the credits. And also there's a lot of the extras are from Sheffield. But we sort of understand nuclear weapons, and this has become a thesis that I have formulated in the past couple of years. We sort of understand nuclear weapons like we understand true crime.
Right.
Right. Like, we have this idea that serial killer bad, but serial killer also sexy. And so you have nuclear weapon bad, nuclear weapon also kind of sexy. And then you wind up getting movies in the serial killer genre, like the Poughkeepsie Tapes, where the serial killer just outsmarts everyone and no one can possibly understand what's going on in that brain of his. And then you start getting stuff like Fallout, where the nuclear radiation mutates everything and you get cool powers out of it. And you never actually see the human cost of it because we're so focused on this thing that is very unlikely to happen. I can't remember the name of the logical fallacy. It might be like the frequency myth, or basically the idea that the more unlikely something is to happen, the more dangerous we think of it as.
You think that's why we've generated so much art about this?
I think so. And I think some of the art is quite good. Because we talked about Threads, we talked about Testament, talked about the War Game. But then you get stuff like The Sum of All Fears.
This is my next question, is what's your beef with Tom Clancy?
What isn't my beef with Tom Clancy?
Or rather, no, when we talk about Sum of All Fears, are we talking about the Ben Affleck movie?
I'm talking about the Ben Affleck movie. There's a couple of really cute lines in it. Like when he's in bed with the woman he's sleeping with, she's like, you have a problem and it's that you're in love with me. And I'm like, okay, that's actually kind of charming. But then you have the line where Morgan Freeman's like, yes, we have these drills for worldwide nuclear war, but what would be more dangerous is if a random guy gets a hold of a nuke, then we're really in trouble. And then you see a bunch of generically Bedouin scavengers pull a fully active and minimally damaged Israeli nuclear weapon out of the sand where it's been laying for like 20 years. Nobody went to look for it. This is just a find that they discovered, and they pull it out with a fucking flatbed truck and a pulley, and then they sell it to a guy who has a gold ring that has a swastika carved into it, because that's how you know he's a bad guy. And this bad guy's like, oh, I have this nuke. Now I'm going to start war between the US and Russia for reasons. And it's a military movie, so they're trying really hard to show you how smart they are. And nobody gives a fuck.
Like, nobody in the audience gives a fuck?
Or nobody in the movie gives a fuck. They're all treating it like real politics. They're not treating it like the end of the fucking world. They're not treating it like the characters in, again, I'm going to reference Threads here again, sorry. Like the scene where they're watching Protect and Survive, which if you haven't seen Protect and Survive, it's fucking awful. It is so much worse than Duck and Cover. And like Ruth and Jimmy are painting their apartment and Ruth just stops and collapses because she's like, oh my God, what if I have to deliver my child into the apocalypse? Which, spoiler, she does. But meanwhile, in Some of All Fears, it's like they're playing a freaking chess game.
I think it's thinking about it, like war movies are all, I've always thought that like war movies in general are a kind of exploitation. Yes. There's different levels of grossness to them. Right. Mm-hmm. And there's something about nukes that because they've only been used twice mm-hmm. in war, because we have like the John Hershey book and like we know how devastating they are, that when you see them used as a plot point in something like Sum of All Fears, it really highlights how gross turning some of this stuff into entertainment can be if it's not handled properly.
Yep.
Right. It becomes a true crime podcast.
Yeah, very much. It becomes what TV Tropes refers to as the idiot bowl.
Right. Yeah, and that's.
And it's interesting because we sort of have the same brain rot around this that we do around true crime, because you will see so many people nowadays on Twitter or Reddit be like, to give you an example, I saw this morning, this woman is like, oh yeah, you know, sometimes I put on Deadpool for my toddlers because they really like all of the loud visuals and the silly faces that Ryan Reynolds makes. Mm-hmm. And someone commented, why would you show your children this movie unless you are literally grooming them? Like, that's not what grooming means. I know, I've been groomed by older men before. I've seen people say, oh, if somebody's following you around a store, that means they're marking you for human trafficking. We have this sort of mythology around specifically trafficking, gang, and sexual crimes, this elaborate ritual mythology. And like, oh no, guys, I think I was almost trafficked today. This weird thing happened to me. Or, guys, there was a zip tie left on my car door. Should I go to the police or will they kill me if I do that? Like, this sort of, we were talking about how horror becomes this fun adrenaline rush in a controlled environment. But once you start taking it out of a controlled environment where everybody is consenting to the experience, then it starts becoming a problem.
Right. That's how you get people on Twitter advocating for the use of tactical nukes.
It's how you get QAnon.
And how you get QAnon. Yeah.
QAnon would have been fine if it had literally just been a LARP. Like, I have designed a LARP based on how QAnon spread, because I didn't even have to write any new rules. I just had to read the Q drops and listen to QAnon Anonymous, big shout out, and like figure out what paths these people were following. Because at the end of the day, what they actually care about is not child sex trafficking or, you know, cabals of evil people or whatever. They want the dopamine. They just want the dopamine of, oh, I figured this out. Oh my gosh, I figured out this super secret thing. They want to be solving a puzzle. They want to be important. They want to be at the center of a narrative. And yes, you're correct. These people on Twitter who are like, ah, just nuke Russia into glass. Like, I grew up far right. I think I was like 9 years old, 8 years old, 9 years old when the Twin Towers went down. And the number of people in my family in the years passing going, why don't we just nuke the Middle East into glass? It's not like it's a useful region anyway, is astounding to me now.
So how do we then engage with this media responsibly?
Oh, that is a good question. And I'm not sure I don't know that I have an overarching answer. I don't know that I have a solution to this, because people are always going to look for their dopamine wherever they can find it. I'm using dopamine specifically because as somebody who is neurodivergent, I have trouble making dopamine in my own brain, and I know it can be really hard for me to find it. I am the sort of person who, when I'm struggling, will read about genocides. Or I will, you know, watch threads. And I think it becomes really important to have these boundaries between yourself and the material, right? Like, if I am reading about genocides, if I am reading about the Holocaust, if I'm reading Mouse or any of the books I had to read for my history of the Holocaust course in college, or even Shoah, Charnel Houses of Europe for Wraith, The Oblivion, which is actually one of the best tabletop books in existence, because it's not a tabletop book. It's a history book with tabletop elements in it. And I think that's what's really important, is it becomes less about the endorphin generation and more, what can I take from this? Instead of, how can I cause there to be more of this horrible thing that I'm thinking about in my life so I can get more endorphins out of it? Does that make sense?
Yes. No, it makes perfect sense. I mean, as someone who also is pretty attracted to some pretty gross things, mm-hmm. It is something I think about, and it's something I am constantly aware of. what my own personal barriers should be, and what I put out into the world.
Yeah.
Right.
And it's hard. I won't lie to you. I'm not perfect. I've made missteps. I'm sure you have too. And the best part is the best thing we can do at that point is be like, hey, I fucked up. Let me do what I can to mitigate this and move on. But like, if people are interested in nuclear weapons texts, like there's a lot of good stuff out there. You just need to know where to look. I finished rereading Jeffrey Lewis's, I think it was 2022 commission on the U.S., the North Korean attacks on the U.S.
Right. When Twitter causes a nuclear war, written by a guy who would know how that would happen, is very engaging.
So it was very, very good.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is, again, we were talking about Dr. Strangelove earlier and how it sounds like the sort of conversations we're having today. And it does. Like this, Jeffrey Lewis is a professor of nuclear history and policy, isn't he? You would know better than I. You've had him on the show.
That's not. I'll just say yes.
Okay. But it's an incredible text because it is written like an investigation or commission report, and it's still just bananas. Like the level of absolute, I don't even know the word for this, the level of absolute nonsense you have to get to in order for a nuclear weapon to actually be fired is a lot. Like it involves Trump getting punched by one of his aides in one of the most memorable scenes. Actually, the aide who is carrying the nuclear football in that scene fucking punches Trump in the face. It's very, very cathartic. Because Trump wants to instigate the war.
Everyone should read that. I think, yes. I think it's interesting, especially now because that particular scare.
Right. Yeah.
So it makes it, I think, a little bit more palatable at the moment because we can look back in hindsight, he's not in power. Nothing happened.
Yeah.
Well, on that front. But I think it makes it easier to digest. So for anyone that wants to get, that is fresh to this stuff, that is their nuclear anxiety is just starting. What do you recommend as like a starting point, either fiction or nonfiction, to like learn and engage in this stuff and get like better educated and also allay some of your fears?
One of my favorite tools is Alex Wellerstein's Nuke Map. It is an interactive tool that you can see how a nuke would affect your city directly or indirectly. I strongly recommend it. That is the only nuke map I recommend, because if you go looking for maps of nuclear targets, you will find maps that are basically out of date by between 20 and 60 years, and you will just scare yourself. Please do not do that. Please do read Dr. Jeffrey Lewis's book. It is wonderful. You will really enjoy it. It's written very frankly, but also officially. So it's actually a surprisingly easy read. It is very much a political thriller in some ways, but it is not the sort of political thriller that uses a nuke as a cute little go away button, which is sort of my derogatory nickname for stuff like Sum of All Fears. Definitely watch The War Game. The War Game is very good. Some people may say, oh, you know, you should watch or read When the Wind Blows because it's our cartoon and that makes it easy. Do not.
No, that one's hard. That one's rough.
It's wonderful. It's very good if you want to cry a lot. Yeah. That's another movie that has a nuclear denouement.
Yeah. Almost the whole movie is a nuclear denouement, really.
I think we've coined a new term here. That's very exciting.
Yeah, I like it.
If you want to look into actual international relations papers on this stuff, Alex Wendt is my favorite international relations theorist. He's a little weird, but he's really fun.
All the nuke people are a little weird.
Well, he's a constructivist. He's not specifically a nuke person, but he's the sort of person who wrote papers titled Sovereignty in the UFO.
Nice. Okay. You're going to have to send me some Alex Wendt stuff.
I sure will. you can have me on to talk about norms and values next time, because boy, howdy, do I have a lot to say about that.
I sent you the Carol Cohn papers.
You did, right? Yes.
Yeah.
You should mention Carol Cohn too, because she was, I loved the sort of feminist approach to nuclear war theory, because as we said earlier in the episode, a lot of fiction tends to have the nuclear weapons being the dick that people are throwing on the table and being like, how are you going to handle this? And I think in some ways, a lot of our favorite nuclear movies that we've mentioned tend towards a more feminist interpretation.
Yeah, they have there's a lot of women at the center of the stories, and it's about kind of their experiences, right?
And it's about their community.
And it's about the communities, yeah. Like, well, you know, it's in the title, Threads, right? It's about the delicate threads that interweave everybody. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Carol Cohn is an academic and did a lot of really amazing work, just kind of what I would call like academically calling bullshit on.
Sure did.
The way that people in charge, the nuclear priesthood, we call them, the people that are actually in charge of this stuff.
Oh my God, I forgot that's where that term came from. And it's such a good term.
It's so good.
Because it is very much this religion about who gets access to nuclear weapons and why they get access to nuclear weapons and the rituals that surround nuclear weapons. And again, the sort of brain rot that goes into thinking about nuclear weapons in the same way that we think about true crime, and this almost, I don't want to say theocratic, but this almost fantastic religious way.
I'm
thinking about them. It's not something that could possibly happen or something that could possibly be banal. It's something that we want to experience almost in a theophany.
I'm reading a book right now. It's nonfiction, Russian Nuclear Orthodoxy. It's by a Russian academic, and it's about the relationship between the Russian Orthodox Church and their nuclear priesthood. And it
is. Are you going to send me your copy once you're finished with it?
I will send you the copy once I'm finished with it. It's fascinating. All right, but we've got to go. Thank you for coming on to Angry Planet.
Can I plug my pluggables?
Yes, plug your pluggables.
To quote Robert Evans.
It's good for us.
But you can find all of my links on Linktree/Rufflejacks. That's Linktree/RUFFLEJAX. You can also find me on JacquelineBrick.design, which is my personal website. Also, please go check out Alex Wellerstein, Dr. Jeffrey Lewis, Martin Pfeiffer, all those wonderful nuclear folks that I follow and that Matthew follows, who do a wonderful job of sort of breaking down the anthropology and sociology of the nuclear weapon.
Jax, thank you so much for coming on to Angry Planet
and
walking us through this.
This has been a dream come true.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.